allowing the expansion into other areas. As Mr. McMahon said, the Savings and Loan Association, because of the federal regulations, is limited in what it could have done. The holding company would have had more freedom to do that.
Really, what you wanted to do is take assets out of the savings and loan and diversify the holding company.
Wanted to be in a position to do that, yes, Your Honor. But not assets out of the Savings and Loan Association. Those assets remained in the association.
But you've already told me the holding company had additional assets other than New Texas Federal.
It was its intent to have so, Your Honor.
And wasn't the reorganization to enable the holding company to diversify? The reorganization in New Texas Federal, wasn't that in fact to enable the holding company to diversify?
I believe that would be a fair characterization.
And isn't that the exact purpose for having a golden parachute clause, is to save these people when reorganization occurs after an exchange of ownership of shares of stock?
I do not believe that's the purpose of a golden parachute, Your Honor. I believe the golden parachutes are designed to protect employees at that point in time when third parties have come in and reorganized, perhaps through a reverse triangle merger or whatever, but new entities enter that transaction and change the company. That's not what happens here. The ultimate control of these companies remained exactly the same.
Counsel, let me ask something as a practical matter. You say this man had 10 months left on his employment contract.
Yes, sir.
He was being paid $61,000 a year?
$71,000.
$71,000. Okay, that's about $6,000 a month. Don't you think you'd have been better off just to pay him the $60,000 he had coming?
We paid him through November the 1st, Your Honor. Hindsight is always 20/20. In this case, we believe that Mr. Seelock deserved to be fired.
What was the date of his firing?
September the 19th.
And why did you pay him until November the 1st?
Because Mr. Williams had previously told him that he was being relieved and would pay him until November the 1st. He told him that in August of 1983. There are memoranda in the record exhibits between Mr. Williams and Mr. Seelock which reflect that he had been told in August that he would be off the payroll effective November the 1st.
And that's all in the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought you said he was fired because he made a demand on September the 16th.
That is the ultimate event that transpired, Your Honor. I'm sorry?
What's the penultimate event?
The series of events concerning his firing started in April of 1983 when he was relieved of all responsibilities as a senior vice president in charge of electronic data processing. He was told over the summer then that, that Texas Federal could not find another position in-house for him, and as a result of that, that he should look for a job elsewhere. He was told that, according to his own admission, on several occasions during that summer. Finally, in August of 1983, there was an exchange of memos in which Mr. Williams advised him that he would remove him from the payroll and he would no longer be an employee as of November the 1st. On September the 16th, Mr. Seelock attempted to exercise rights to claim accelerated stock options, which Mr. Williams felt was an absolute breach of his contract, and so he removed him from the premises on Monday, September the 19th, and gave him a 10-day formal notice under his contract, but still paid him until November the 1st because he had previously agreed to.
Mr. Coleman, liquidated damage provision was applied at the amount of yearly salary. You mentioned the figure of $1 million. How did you arrive at that?
The number found for the total annual compensation, and the actual phrase is then total annual compensation, was $395,000.
That salary for bonuses or what?
The jury obviously included within that amount some $270,000 that relates to the Bright Bank merger that occurred 15 months after he was fired. That's set forth in our original brief, and is, I think, correctly decided by the dissent when he points out that the word then means obviously as of the date of termination, and the 700,000 plus prejudgment interest therefore could not be sustained, and that the correct amount of his twice annual compensation would be $184,000.
Mr. Goldman, I need a little bit more help on your argument that the outstanding voting securities of Texas Federal did not change. Now, as I understand, before this plan to form the holding company and do the reverse triangle merger came into being, the owners of the outstanding voting securities of Texas Federal had the right to vote on the officers, to elect the officers and directors of the corporation. That's about what stockholders have a right to do as far as voting securities. After the reverse triangle merger, the people who held these almost identical voting securities had the right to elect the officers of Texas Federal Savings, Texas Federal Financial Corporation.
Yes, sir.
And you're saying that there was no change in electing the officers and electing the directors of Texas Federal Savings and electing the directors of the new holding company, Texas Federal Financial Corporation.
In fact, it was the same individuals.
But they were voting on different people, were they not? They were voting on the directors of the new entity, new legal entity, instead of the old legal entity.
That would be correct.
Why would that not be a change in the outstanding voting securities of Texas Federal then? Because the Texas Federal Financial Corporation was then the owner of the securities of Texas Federal Savings, and they would elect the directors of that corporation.
You have to go back to the language of the agreement, in my judgment.
That's what I'm looking at. Right where you're pointing.
And the outstanding voting securities of Texas Federal did not vest in Texas Federal Financial Corporation. This transaction results in those stock certificates changing in character, changing from the stock of a company into the right to receive the stock of another company. If that's a disappearance, it's a legal disappearance. I suggest to you that it's the same type of disappearance that the plaintiff is talking about in this case when they say magically the 1,000 shares of stock changed into the 1,000,005 shares of Texas Federal stock.
But if I exchange my Texas Federal stock for Texas Financial stock, I can only elect officers in Texas Financial. I can't any longer elect officers in Texas Federal, can I? Because I'm not a stockholder in Texas Federal any longer. I'm only a stockholder in Texas Financial.
In the ultimate sense, that is correct.
Is there anything unusual about this? Isn't this what transpires every time there's an acquisition? One corporation acquires another one and merges into it? Or
this is what the law says happens anytime you have
nothing unusual.
A federally regulated merger.
Nothing unusual happened to the stock in this particular case.
No, it's the same as it happens in all cases.
Any further questions? Thank you, Tim.
May it please the court, I will attempt to be mercifully brief lest I be accused of merely compounding confusion. I have decided after assisting with the brief in this case, reading a proxy statement for the first time in my life, that unsophisticated small-town lawyers such as myself who get involved in these cases should be issued lead parachutes and a one-day membership in a skydiving club. Because what seems so simple to me is made to appear to be so complicated. I represent a fine executive who was given a standard industry contract approved by the Federal Home Loan Board. It contained a golden parachute clause that said it would activate if 10% of the outstanding voting securities or more of the employer for whom he worked became vested in someone else. And before this merger, he worked for a corporation which was owned by the holders of 1.5 million shares of common stock. And after this merger, he worked for a holding company that owned 100% of the shares of common stock of his employer. And if that's not a change, then I don't understand what change is. And I think that perhaps to just crystallize where I think we are, my rebuttal time would probably best be used to try to identify the pressure points in terms of the opposing arguments that you have heard. As I hear our worthy opposition's approach to this case, it takes two avenues, neither of which they're real sure that they're comfortable with. The one which is put forth in the brief is the one which Mr. McMaines addressed, which is that actually after this merger, Mr. Seelock didn't work for the same association. It was a completely different association. Now, in argument to this court, we are back to, it seems to me, the literal, physical, paper stock certificate argument, which goes something like this. If you look at Mr. Seelock's employment contract, it just talks about outstanding voting security. And this contract was not concerned really about ownership. It was concerned with a paper trail. And so what happened was, when the reverse triangular merger was put together, the literal physical stock certificate went to Texas Federal Financial, but they did not. Somehow or another, it has just simply vaporized. Now, I have a substantive rebuttal to that argument, but it seems to me that there are the seeds of the destruction of that argument in the very words that you have heard in response to questions from this court. I believe it was Mr. Justice Wallace that says, and others, who, what has happened to these stock certificates? Well, we have them in our vaults, but perhaps we've destroyed them. Well, how, in the name of the law, do they destroy those stock certificates after getting them in their coffers if they don't own them? And so I submit to you that that argument is merely a subterfuge. But on a more substantive level, here is what was taking place and what they were representing to the public in a proxy statement, which they recognize has to be true and accurate. And that is that what we were really doing in this convoluted transaction was public shareholders of Texas Federal Savings are exchanging stock for TFFC. And they said this to the public: pursuant to the terms of the merger, the corporation, that's TFFC, will issue in exchange for outstanding shares of association common stock, which is Texas Federal, Seelock's employer, common stock shares of the corporation common stock. Now, how, again, in the name of the law, is that anything other than a complete swap of 100% of ownership? Of course it was. This whole transaction was structured to come under the Internal Revenue guidelines relative to tax-free exchanges.
In a tax-free exchange, the basic underlying concept is you give me something and I give you something. And yet the whole thesis of their argument is that what we did was shareholders of Texas Federal Savings, you gave us something, or pardon me, we gave you something, but you gave us nothing. I just submit that this is really absurd. The proxy statement states, as I have read to you, that the exchange was for the ownership of Texas Federal Savings. At one point in the proxy statement, they even go so far as to say that TFFC, the holding company, is actually purchasing the stock of Texas Federal Savings. And that's on page 3, paragraph 3 on page 32 of the proxy statement. After this transaction was occurred, TFFC and Texas Federal have both acknowledged that they were separate and distinct entities that had to be owned by someone, and they have acknowledged that TFFC owns all of the stock of CELOC's employer. That is in the midst of the change of ownership in the golden parachute. But the interesting thing about all of this, in terms of how TFFC gets its ownership of the savings and loans, is through a very, very interesting provision. And I think this is probably where the confusion is coming. It's a very, very interesting provision of the merger agreement, which opposing counsel has not read to you. You see, we're all concerned now about how does TFFC get its ownership of Texas Federal Savings. Here's how they do it. And this is the magical part, I suppose, of a reverse triangular merger. Because it is true that these shares are coming in from the shareholders of the savings and loan. But how does the stock ownership go up? It goes up by this magical conversion. All outstanding shares of other association, common stock, which is New Texas Federal, shall by operation of law and without any action on the part of the corporation or any other holder thereof, become and be converted into the number of shares of common stock of the resulting association, which is CELOC's, equal to the number of shares of association stock outstanding immediately before the effective date. And that is simply the way it works. Texas Federal Savings gets the stock new. It goes up as the identical shares that the savings and loan had before. So there is an immediate rise, which is tantamount to the change of ownership necessary to go with the parachute.
What page of the merger agreement is that on?
That is, Your Honor, paragraph 5D on page A3 of the merger agreement. Now, let's switch over and just take a look at the new association argument, which we haven't heard too much about. The proxy statement says in at least 3 instances that between the merger between new and old, that old is the surviving corporation. Now, the merger agreement mandates that the old association continue under the charter of, the resulting association continue under the charter and the bylaws of the old association. Now, you can't tell me that this is some new association, but here is the denouement of that argument. Just assume the disappearing non-existent stock certificate argument. If it's true, and if we accept it as true, then look what's happened. CELOC is home free again, because the association for which he owns, for which he works, is has the only stock that it owns under their disappearing stock theory, is this 1,000 shares which has been converted into 1.5 million shares. And that stock is then owned by TFSC. And that is just as much a change of ownership is necessary to trigger the golden parachute as the other theory. So they're hung regardless of which way they go. And they are also hung on this hostility-friendly thing. Under their arguments before this court, if there were a hostile takeover under exactly the same kinds of documents, CELOC would have no rights. The very man who was instrumental in this convoluted murder presented Mr. CELOC with an amendment to both his stock option agreement and his contract, and when asked, which excluded this merger from the golden parachute, and when asked, why did you do that? He said, well, I was just being cautious because, at page 238 of the statement of facts, the transaction that was to take place in then, I think, September of 1983, could be construed as having some effect on the employment agreement. That was perfect. The judgment should be the judgment of the trial court should be judgment of the court of appeals should be reversed. Judgment of the trial court affirmed.
Counsel, before you leave, I'm going to ask you a question. I think Judge Robertson does too. I'm not sure I quite yet understand when old Texas Federal merged with new Texas Federal, the shareholders of new Texas Federal got what in exchange for their stock?
Good question. Good question. They got ownership of old.
But they didn't yet have the stock certificates of old.
Yeah, they did. Because that stock certificate is owned by TFSC.
In other words, that was a part of the merger agreement.
Right. That's what, you see, I was trying to say a while ago, that's what creates an ownership by TFSC in old, is those new stock certificates.
And when that occurred, and your client no longer worked for Texas Federal, it worked for Texas Financial.
No. He worked for Texas Federal Savings all along. A company which was, prior to the merger, owned by the owners of 1.5 million shares, and after the merger, was owned by a holding company. Have I answered your question?
Yeah.
Okay, so Judge Robertson?
You said that judgment of stock, of course, should be affirmed. So my understanding is there's some insufficiency arguments for the court of appeals are not accepted.
Your Honor,
yeah, these are prejudgment interest claims.
Yes.
They're the prejudgment interest claim, I think, is a question of law. It's simply a matter of accrual date. Accrual date's wrong, the court can change it. Your Honor, the only, let's assume, we've got to assume a number of things. If this court agrees with us,
that's right,
on the triggering effect of the golden parachute, the only factual sufficiency argument that I can find that's being made relates to the amount of damages. Now, the complaints which are being made are not your traditional excessiveness points. This is just simply too much money. It is that, well, you can't include the basis, the benefits from his stock option in that amount of damages. You can't include bonus. You can't include this. matters which are simply a question of the measure of damages as a matter of law. So
you're
I think
saying we have jurisdiction over that.
Yes. And I'm simply saying that once you defeat those arguments, you defeat them on a legal basis. It's really more a question of measure of damages, and I will point out to the court that the savings and loan did not, in objections to special issue number 6, ever request any limiting instructions to exclude any particular segment of damage. So I think that this argument, Mr. Justice Robertson, is essentially a wolf in sheep's clothing argument, an attempt to get back to a fairly friendly, what they perceive is at least a very friendly forum. But upon close analysis, you'll find that it involves nothing more than questions over the measure of damages. And we have authority for the fact that an employee who is terminated in the midst of a term employment contract, which affixes to that employment stock option rights, may well recover the value that those stock option rights would have had during the term of the contract.
I hate to detain you, but if we assume, for the sake of argument, their position that a stockholder had a share of stock and he's the same one the next day when he gets a new one.
Stockholder.
All right, so that hasn't changed, okay? If we assume that, so that the public stockholders just got a different piece of paper, right? Is there somewhere in your statement of facts evidence to show that the 10% or more of the ownership went to the new entity? Surely they didn't just trade out 100% stock or 100% stock. Was there 10% or more that went into new hands with all of this transaction?
Your Honor, I think our answer to that is 100% went into new hands.
Yeah, I've heard you say that. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court will take a brief recess.
All right.